Blog Talk Radio.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atkins?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much, and that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Only people's gardens. They'll nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
That was a clip from To Kill a Mockingbird. This week, playwright-screenwriter Horton Foote, who movingly portrayed the broken dreams of common people in The Trip to Bountiful, Tender Mercies, and, of course, his Oscar-winning adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird. Foote died Wednesday in Connecticut. He was 92. And we have made it one of the things we wanted to do on this show is acknowledge writers of the past, and one of the ways we can do that is to honor them and their work. And unfortunately, this is kind of a somber way to begin the show, but Horton Foote's adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird, I think, is one of the classic screenwriting triumphs, especially considering today's level of adaptation. And we recently have had some pretty good ones, but I think Horton Foote is definitely someone we're going to miss. Devin, would you agree with that? Have you had a chance to see To Kill a Mockingbird recently, his adaptation?
Actually, I saw it back in high school in my English class when we read the book. It was pretty much a given we were going to watch the movie, too. And I think he did a very good job adapting it, and the Oscar that he was given was very well-deserved for it.
I think it's a given that everyone in high school watches To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, we watched it when I was in school, and we, of course, you know, read the book. And I always thought that his adaptation was, in a way, kind of a little bit better than the book. I don't know if that might be that's not usually the case. Certainly, that's very rarely the case that the adaptation is as good as the book.
In some cases, it's even better. I think Harper Lee actually did say he liked the movie version better than the original novel that he wrote.
I think the last adaptation that I thought was better than the novel was Frank Darabont's adaptation of Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption in novella that Stephen King wrote. I think even Stephen King acknowledged that Frank Darabont's adaptation of that was superior to his own novella. So once again, anyways, we just want to honor Horton Foote and kind of start the show off with that. Welcome to Screen Talk Radio. We are the only weekly hour-long show dedicated to you, the screenwriter. We will be here every week, except I guess next week, Devin, we won't be here for spring break. You and I are going to take a week off. I know I'm going to be headed to the ocean, hang out a little bit. You'll be doing your writing and working on finishing up your book that you got coming out. But we'll be back the week after that. It would be the 18th, I guess, of March. We'll be back, hopefully, with some exciting new guests. And we'll be looking at March doing another script pitch fest live with, hopefully, Christopher Lockhart and maybe some other executives. But check back for that, and we'll look forward to talking with you. But anyways, our call-in number is 646-716-5193. We're going to be taking calls possibly with Craig Kellum, former development executive at 20th Century Fox. He's going to talk about kind of the art of the pitch a little bit. We're going to keep that as a constant theme through the next month or so as we do some of these pitch fests we're going to have. And Craig Kellum is an excellent guest because he has a lot of experience in the world of film, but also in the world of writing and pitching, and he's created some hit series such as Charles in Charge. So he's going to be on our show, and if we have somebody who wants to call in and pitch Craig their story and kind of get some feedback from him, he'll be willing to take that call, and we look forward to that. Sponsors this hour are Final Draft. Use what the professionals use, Final Draft. You can get more information about Final Draft at their website, finaldraft.com, or you can sign up and join screenwritersutopia.com for free and get some nice coupons and discounts for Final Draft and their other products. All right, Devin, we're going to bring in Script Girl in a moment and hear what's been going on with the latest script sales in Hollywood, and then we'll talk about what's been going on recently. Here she is, Script Girl in Hollywood.
Hi, this is Script Girl in Hollywood with your weekly script sales report for Friday, February 27th, 2009. Well, it's a slumdog world. After Danny Boyle's Mumbai mashup took home the gold and DreamWorks' mega financing deal with the Indian conglomerate Reliance, it seems the entire industry is scrambling to Bollywoodize their upcoming projects. First up, a good friend of the show, Jack Olson, sold his spec thriller Within to Screen Gems. It's about a husband who finds himself having to fend off sexual advances from the surrogate he and his wife hired to carry their child. The pot finally boils over when the rented womb's intentions turn homicidal. Jack told me he wrote the script in between late-night feedings of his infant son, who he and his wife conceived on the first day of the writer's strike. Bob Shea and Dylan Sellers will produce. Olson is repped by Charles Ferraro and Kaya Kayashian of the United Talent Agency. Another friend of the show, Jeff LaTulip, is back on the Cadillac board this week with the sale of his romantic comedy horror hybrid, Breathers, A Zombie's Lament, to Fox Searchlight. Based on S.G. Brown's yet-to-be-published novel, the story's about a newly minted zombie who's having trouble adjusting and seeks help at Undead Anonymous meetings. Diablo Cody and Mason Novick will produce. LaTulip is repped by Sarah Self of the Gersh Agency. This is Jeff's second sale on the report, so you know, I think that warrants a congratulatory phone call. Hey, Jeff, how's my favorite screenwriter?
Hey, Script Girl. I'm good. How are you doing?
So, Jeff, this is your second sale in a year. You must be excited.
Yeah, I would say I'm excited. It feels like I got a lot less money the second time around.
Well, you're obviously doing something right. Any advice for aspiring writers?
I would say read as many screenplays as you can, both good and bad, and I would learn to live without a lot of sleep.
You must really be catnip to the ladies, huh?
Probably not my strong suit.
Oh, Jeff, could you hold on? Dustin Lance Black's on the other line.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Hey, Dusty. How's my favorite screenwriter?
It's still me. This is still Jeff.
So, Jeff, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
I don't know. An oak tree? Oak trees have acorns. I like acorns.
Great answer. Well, Jeff, I know you're busy, so I'm going to go ahead and let you go.
Script Girl, isn't it your birthday today?
Yeah, it is. Thanks for remembering.
Let me be the first. Alrighty, Script Girl, I'll talk to you later.
That's so sweet, Jeff. Thanks. Talk to you later. Next up, Ed Helms and Jake Fleischer sold their untitled Civil War-era pitch to Carousel Productions. The comedy is about a group of Civil War reenactors who are accidentally transported back in time, finding themselves trapped in the actual war between the states. Steve Carell and Vance DeGeneres will produce. Helms is repped by CAA's Jason Heyman. All three are alums of The Daily Show. Actress Eliza Dushku secured the life rights of Robert Mapplethorpe for The Perfect Moment, a biopic spanning the iconic photographer's childhood, his professional career, and his untimely death in a Boston hospital. Dushku and Andy Timiner will produce. Timiner is also slated to direct. That's all for now. Remember, you can't sell it if you don't write it.
Happy birthday, Anna.
All right, that was Script Girl in Hollywood. Once again, we appreciate her taking time to let us play her weekly show. You can listen to Script Girl on her website, scriptgirl.net. She's got weekly script sales, and we appreciate her allowing us to play her weekly show, scriptgirl.net. Devin, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
I am an oak.
Oh, come on. I'm a cherry tree because I just love cherries. So
okay.
I'd be a, and plus Washington was rumored to have chopped one down. Anyways, if you're calling in for Craig Kellum and to pitch your screenplay and get feedback, don't go anywhere. We've got several people on the line already, and we'll be taking calls about 6:30 LA time when we have Craig Kellum live. We will be playing here in a minute our interview with David Goyer, courtesy of The Dialogue. And, Devin, let's talk about some of those script sales there. I think you and I both kind of were caught our eye by the Untitled Civil War project that has, I think, Steve Carell attached. He's producing it. To me, it sounded like Galaxy Quest meets, I don't know, Glory or something. But certainly I could see Steve Carell playing a Civil War reenactor, you know, a really serious gung-ho, gets thrown back in time to the real American Civil War. I think it sounds interesting. What do you think of that potential? And it's written by Ed Helm. I believe he's also an actor, and he's producing with Steve Carell.
I know that you have a bit of a thing for the Civil War yourself, but I just found it rather hilarious. I thought of it as like Tropic Thunder, a more recent, you know, more recent movie, same kind of general idea, Tropic
right.
Thunder with a little bit of maybe Back to the Future, I don't know, since we don't really know that much, we just got basically the log line for the movie. It sounds like it probably would be rather hilarious, especially
right.
You got the writers from The Daily Show, the guys who actually
yeah.
work on The Daily Show, they're hilarious anyway, in my opinion, so... This might actually be worth watching. You know, this will be like your movie to watch, and I'll go watch Pride and Predator.
If you guys are listening, last week we had Bill Martell on. You know, Bill Martell was—he's a character, and it was a great interview. And we'll hope to have him back, Bill Martell. Anyways, Devin, some other sales. I don't know if Script Girl mentioned it, but I was looking through the script sales on ScreenwritersUtopia.com. Nottingham, another Brian Grazer, Russell Crowe film. This one, Ridley Scott is attached to direct, and Crowe is attached to star along with Cate Blanchett. Brian Helgeland is, rewrote a previous draft. But anyways, Nottingham, the story of Robin of Locksley, an original story that comes close to historical facts of the period, abandoned as a child. He finds community with the common people of Nottingham. Robin's abandonment and trust issues hampers ability to fall in love. He meets his match in Marion, a strong, independent woman. So we're going to get Robin Hood. Do you really think that movie will make it to production or not? Do we need to see Robin Hood again? Of course, I think it fits in timely with the political times. We're going to rob from the rich and give to the poor.
Yeah. I think Ridley Scott, if anything, Ridley Scott, he makes very beautiful movies. They are visually very, very stunning. And he has worked with Russell Crowe before in Gladiator, so there's that there. He might actually turn out something good here that we might not have ever seen before. Scott's...
True, and I'm a big fan of Brian Helgeland. I mean, he's an exceptional writer, and if he's involved, I'm definitely game to give it a shot if it does make it to screen.
Yeah, and if it's... You got somebody okay. You got Russell Crowe. Yeah, he can do British better than well, better than some of the American actors who played Robin Hood. So,
well, looking at the script sales, we're not going to spend too much time on it. But my pick of the week was the Suicide Squad, written by Justin Marks. That's the story of a team of supervillains given one last shot of redemption by the government by accomplishing missions that would most likely kill them. Suicide Squad, that's my pick of the week.
Sounds like the Dirty Dozen.
Right, but it also goes back to... Well, yeah, but that goes back to, you know, Seven Samurai and Kurosawa. I mean, everything kind of evolved from Kurosawa and his masterpiece, Seven Samurai.
Which also,
yeah, of course. And
which were also Meiji-era Japanese feudal Japan type stories anyway that he had developed too. So, yeah, nothing new under the sun, but it sounds like, yeah, a superhero or supervillain in this case, Dirty Dozen.
Right.
Which might be interesting. I mean, it's like, hey, let's take two different genres and just mash them together and see what happens.
Never know. All right, those are the script sales for the week. Up next is our interview with David Goyer. He was interviewed by Mike DeLuca for The Dialogue. You might know Goyer. He's a screenwriter of last year's hit movie The Dark Knight, directed by Christopher Nolan. And I think most of us would agree that the Dark Knight should have been nominated for Best Picture and Nolan for Best Director, but that wasn't the way the Academy saw it. Goyer's breakout came in 1998 when he wrote the action hit Blade, starring Wesley Snipes, based on the Marvel Comics vampire hunter, who is himself half-vampire. Anyways, here's the 9-minute teaser of the interview that you can listen to in its entirety on the Dialogue website. Here's that teaser, 9-10 minutes with David Goyer.
I'm Mike DeLuca. Welcome to this rare in-the-trenches look at the craft of screenwriting. Today I'm sitting here with the Prince of Darkness, writer, producer, director David Goyer, the man behind Batman Begins, the Blade series, Dark City, Crow City of Angels, Flash, and 1,000 other movies I'm probably forgetting. How'd you get so busy? And welcome.
Thanks for having me. How'd I get so busy? I'm a workaholic, I guess.
Where does Prince of Darkness come from?
Prince of Darkness, originally...
You're a nice guy.
I am a nice guy.
You love children and pets.
Bunny rabbits and sunsets and long walks on the beach. A high school teacher dubbed me that, and somehow I was doing some interview with Premier Magazine, and that stuck, and then they did an article, and then in the lame way that other, you know, articles and magazines, yeah, they're just suddenly he's the Prince of Darkness. So.
When did you decide to be a screenwriter? Was it always that for you, or did you come to it?
I was going to be a homicide detective in Michigan. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I had been accepted to Michigan State, and I was going to get a degree in police administration and become a homicide detective. And some of my high school teachers just flipped out and called up my mother and said, we think he should be a screenwriter, bizarrely.
Wow, like specifically screenwriter?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
To my surprise, I was accepted to USC and decided to go. And upon arriving at USC, was promptly kicked out of beginning screenwriting for arguing too much with my teacher.
Did you pick up stuff at USC that was
different? I mean, I clearly did. In my case, I knew nothing about filmmaking or screenwriting,
right.
And I was just coming from Michigan. So obviously I learned something. But nowadays, with the internet and all these other tools, I don't know that it's entirely necessary
right.
to go to film school. I mean, there's so many filmmakers that
yeah.
didn't go to film school that are successful. And just the whole aspect of filmmaking is so much more accessible to people now.
Was there a particular moment where you gained full confidence of your skills as a screenwriter where you didn't, you know, I don't know if you ever had doubts, but was there a moment where you're like, I got it, this is going to work?
Yeah, actually, it was the script for Blade.
Okay.
I mean, I had been writing professionally for at least 5 years before that, and, you know, looking back on it, I look at some of the stuff I had written
right.
and even gotten made and said, God, I can't
pretty
believe.
Good Van Damme movie.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah, but that's
before
like,
Blade,
that's
right.
like saying, you know, I don't know what to say. Like, it's the best Steven Seagal movie. Okay, great. Or it's the best Dolph Lundgren.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. That was the first thing
mm-hmm.
I'd done, which was this Van Damme movie, Death Warrant. But I think Blade was maybe the 8th or 9th script I had written.
Okay.
And it was the first time that I felt like everything just clicked.
Right.
And for me, prior to Blade, even though I wrote the script, it took about 4 years for the film to be made.
Right.
Prior to Blade, I was still auditioning for jobs. I really had to pitch myself really hard. And what was interesting with Blade, and this can happen with screenwriters, is the movie hadn't been made, but it had become this sort of infamous script that was
right.
circulating around town that people really liked. And it happens every once in a while, and you can make a name for yourself on something that even doesn't get made.
Mm-hmm.
And after Blade, I, for the first time, just got offered projects
right.
without having to audition for them.
What attracts you to dark material over things that might be more like fantastical or escapist or a little lighter?
I mean, I like seeing lighter fare, but clearly the kind of themes that I'm attracted to, I mean, every movie I've ever done with the exception of Batman Begins has been R-rated,
mm-hmm.
and Batman Begins is certainly, I think, about as dark a PG-13 film as you could get, mm-hmm. and certainly people were surprised at how dark it was. And I mean, I'm really interested in anti-heroes. I'm really interested in characters that are conflicted. I'm interested in characters that have to sort of go to a dark place, and people that are alienated and whatnot, probably because I'm sure there's a little bit of
right.
my own experience as a kid or something like that in there.
What do you think was the beginning of this kind of current wave of superhero movies?
The first really significant comic book movie was the Richard Donner Superman film in 1978. Mm-hmm. The next really significant one was Tim Burton's Batman film. But they didn't really open the floodgates in terms of all these other superhero movies. And that really happened with the first Blade film that you and I did, actually. And the reason for that, I guess, is because aside from the Batman and Superman franchises over at DC being somewhat dormant, Marvel itself was in bankruptcy.
Right.
And I remember the very first meeting we had for Blade was the first day that Avi Arad, who's now the head of Marvel,
right.
you know, got on the job. And what was significant about that film is it wasn't a well-known property. It wasn't the jewel of Marvel's crown. It was
right.
a C-list character that didn't even have his own comic book. And it was significant because there was always this assumption that you can make comic book movies out of maybe five characters over at DC and five over at Marvel, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
But they realized with Blade, this totally C-list character, oh my God, this character in and of itself can generate a $300 million franchise, and oh my God, we've got 9,000 characters. It's just a free-for-all.
The fans have always said, we want this kind of Batman. They showed up for Tim Burton's Batman. They showed up for your Batman and Chris Nolan's Batman. The fans have continually said, not just comic book fans, but moviegoers, we want it to be treated seriously. Not that it has to be dour, but we want it appropriately treated. Characters lasted for 75 years. Why did they let it drift into camp?
I think it's a generational thing. I mean, first of all, the public's conception of Batman, and this is specific to Batman, aside from the fans, is the 60s TV show.
Where are those people who want that Batman? I've never run into one of those people.
I don't think they want it,
right.
but I think that's what they think of as Batman.
Right.
And so my grandmother, my uncle, my mother, they didn't read comic books. They don't know the Dark Knight from,
right.
you know, whatever. But the other thing I think is that it's a generational thing. I think what's happening now with filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro and, you know, Singer and Nolan and, you know, Sam Raimi and
Proyas,
to a lesser extent, you know, myself, we all grew up actually being weaned on these comic books. We loved them. We sort of, you know, ate, breathed, and slept them.
Right.
And again, we weren't looking down at the material. And I think it took that generation of filmmakers to come of age in order to really treat them seriously for the studios to get it.
Like a generational thing.
Exactly.
Did they approach you about The Flash? Like, did you get a phone call and say, we want to, or did you go to them and say?
No, after Batman Begins, Warner Brothers owns DC Comics, and they'd obviously had a good experience on that. And so they came to me and said, which was fun, especially for comic book
right.
geek like me, and said, any DC character you want, what do you want to do? We want to do another.
Right.
They were primarily pushing Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, or The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
I had no particular love for Wonder Woman. And I just thought The Flash would be fun and that no one had really exploited those powers
right.
you know, cinematically yet. So that's what I'm working on right now.
When you sit down and begin to write a movie like The Flash or any movie that you've worked on, do you think in pictures first and then words or words first?
In the case of The Flash, I did something similar to what I'd done in Batman. The first thing I did was just sat down, locked myself in a room for a week, and just reread everything
right.
I could possibly reread. And I did two things. A, I made a list of just cool moments or lines
mm-hmm.
in no particular order that I just thought had to be in the movie.
Right.
And then I also made a list of, you know, what, if you boil The Flash or you boil Batman down or you boil Blade down, what are the elements that absolutely have to be there? What's the story about? What's the, you know, in the case of Batman, obviously there are core elements that have to be there. But in terms of the theme, you know, it was a story about fear
mm-hmm.
and overcoming your fear and living in the shadow of your father and being afraid that you're not going to, you know, fulfill, you know, what he was trying to do and, you know, honor his memory. In the case of The Flash, I had to do the same thing and figure out what's the metaphor, what's the theme of this movie. And what I decided for The Flash, should we be fortunate enough to make it, is it's the Icarus myth, in a way, that speed is the only modern vice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all these vices that exist time immemorial, but speed is something relatively new,
right.
And it's addictive. And, you know, if you run too fast, you'll run yourself literally out of existence, but you'll also sort of won't be able to stop and smell the roses, and you'll leave the people you love
right.
behind. And so that's sort of the emotional core.
All right, that was an interview of David Goyer. That's from the Dialogue series. You can listen to more of that interview by visiting thedialogueseries.com, interview of David Goyer. You're listening to Screen Talk Radio Live. Up next is our interview with Craig Kellum, former development executive at 20th Century Fox, and he's going to talk about pitching, and we'll take a couple of calls. We have people calling already. We'll take some callers, and Mr. Kellum will work with them on giving them some advice on their pitches. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Screen Talk Radio. Back to Screen Talk Radio. We'll be joined here shortly by Craig Kellum, former executive at 20th Century Fox. Devin, David Goyer, I think that was a nice clip with him and Mike DeLuca. He talked about the conflicted hero, kind of the anti-hero, the dark hero, and how he was always intrigued by those type of protagonists. And I think, you know, most of us are always intrigued by kind of the darker side of human nature. And is that what you think kind of makes like The Dark Knight and other screenplays and stories by David Goyer something at least appealing, if not unique?
Well, I think it does, because it shows a human side to things, that, you know, they're not these impervious, your heroes are not these impervious tanks. They are people with feelings and their own foibles. And he is very good about exploiting that in the scripts and showing that, you know, there's more to it than just going and beating up the bad guys. There's a lot more to it that you have to, that's underneath the surface. It's just as interesting to explore.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think writers can look at the writing of The Dark Knight and even Spider-Man and look at how you can take a protagonist and take them to that edge of that cliff and show them as the conflicted human being that, well, all of us can be at one time or another. We all are faced with crisis, and we're all faced with deep angst and misery at times. And I think sometimes writers try to make their protagonist too perfect, I guess maybe is what I'm looking for. They don't make them very human. They don't flesh them out enough. And I think that's one of the things that David Goyer was getting at there is that your protagonist is a person, and they're going to have weaknesses. Those are the things that appeal to us.
Yeah, give them an Achilles heel of some kind. It can play into your story quite well if you work it right. And he's very good at doing that. That's why he's still from almost the beginning, he's been working on comic book adaptations and really bringing these heroes to life that way and showing them
right.
in a very human light.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point. Anyway, so if you want to listen to more of the interview with David Goyer, you can go to thedialogueseries.com. All right, we're going to get to our interview and take some phone calls with Craig Kellum. Craig is a former development executive at 20th Century Fox TV, then for Universal for over 14 years. Craig was the vice president in charge of comedy development at Universal for almost 6 years, a writer-producer for 1 year, and executive vice president of the Author Company. He also developed and sold the hit series Charles in Charge, which I personally grew up watching and enjoyed, and then, of course, developed FBI, The Untold Stories, among other things. Let's bring Craig on. Craig, are you there?
Sure am. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Craig. How are you doing? It's nice to finally speak with you. I know we've corresponded often on email, and I appreciate you taking time to join us here tonight.
It's okay. My pleasure.
Craig, I'm also joined by Devin Watson. He's a co-host. He's a professional writer, and we'll be asking some questions. And then I think we're going to take some calls. We've got some people calling already. But our focus in this 10-minute, 15-minute slot was on the pitch. And you certainly have a tremendous amount of experience, I'm sure, not just pitching your own stories, but hearing them as well. And what are some of the main keys or ideas that a writer can focus on when they're developing their, I don't know, 30-second, minute, 2-minute, I don't even know how long some writers get to pitch, but what are some of the keys to a successful pitch in your mind?
Well, I think the primary aspect is to have a good project. I mean, there's nothing like walking in a room where you really have something and you know it. So, you know, that may sound very fundamental and too basic and all of that, but it's really not, because it certainly gives you a real advantage. What I say is that you have to really prep, but the prep involves really remembering, you know, what is your project and why do I like the project and what is the genesis of the project. As I've said, I have an article that I wrote on pitching where I said, you know, I would get all my prep together and I'd be on my way to a pitch at the network or whatever, and and I'd be nervous the way I'm nervous right now. And I would be going, oh, my God, I've got to go up there and face this room, and what am I going to say? And I would start to blank out and go through all the things that people go through prior to pitches. But then what I would do is I would go through this process where, again, I would say, well, what am I doing here? You know, why did I get involved with this project? And then what would happen often is I would begin to click into kind of a flow of remembrance, and that would give me the confidence to go in and begin the pitch. What I recommend is that you work off talking points. In other words, you don't go in and sorry, Chris, I'm really nervous doing this. So I have to kind of slow down. It's kind of, what's the word?
We got
ironic that I'm telling people how to pitch and I'm having trouble doing my own pitch. So I just have to kind of.
I
haven't done this
Craig,
in a while, and I just have to kind of slow it down. So what I would do is, I would basically work off talking points, and that would be that I would have. Oh, God, I'm having a hard time doing this.
I usually just go with the tried and true method of picturing everybody naked, and that usually helps.
As long as
someone's good looking in the room, but if they're butt ugly, Devin, then we're in trouble. I mean, that's.
Well, then you
start laughing at the wrong time.
Thanks for covering me with guys. I'll try this again.
Okay.
I'd put together what I wouldn't do is. Read the page. What I wouldn't do is try to sound canned and over-prepared. I would basically remember what I have, be excited about it, remembering that I'm excited about it, be passionate about it because I got involved with it, so I must be passionate about it, and then go in with the basics, which were basically walking off working off talking points, touching upon the main points of the pitch. Wait a minute.
When you pitched and sold Charles in Charge, for example, did you have to do that in kind of a pitch type way, or how did you propose that project and get it sold? Is there anything there?
Well, the genesis of the project was that I was at Universal, and we had obviously an office in New York, and CBS had an office in New York as well. And basically, CBS was trying to do development and be, you know, relevant and competitive with the West Coast. So we had a deal with a company called Scholastic Productions, which is, of course, that giant publishing company, and this was their television, you know, development and movie development unit.
Right.
And the irony of that particular project was that somebody in the office, some secretary, thought of an idea. And the basic idea was, you know, what would happen if a male au pair became the au pair for a family as opposed to a female au pair, and they'd always have been female au pairs, obviously, in the past. How would that work, particularly if it was kind of a young, attractive guy, et cetera, et cetera? So what happened was that the secretary told the development person at Scholastic. The person at Scholastic liked the idea. She had a writer that she was schmoozing with who was like a, you know, kind of a young playwright type named Michael Jacobs, who really has turned out to be a huge writing star in Hollywood and has been for many, many years now. And basically, they came up, they messed with the idea, and then I was in charge of the department, and they called me, and I liked it. And the reason I liked it was because, you know, there are good ideas out there, but what you really like is when there's an idea that has timeliness to it. Because my whole theory of doing movies and TV is that it provides a certain need. It provides a certain, that's what it's for. It reflects things that are happening out there. It reflects things that are happening in our society that are expressed in great theatrical packages that we go and we're stimulated by and we're interested in and we learn from and we can sympathize with ourselves and understand things better. So it was a very simple thing. They said, you know, male au pair, young, attractive male au pair, and I liked it. So what happens at that point is, in the development of it, very briefly, is that, you know, you have, you know, 400 meetings with these people. You talk about, you know, shaping the pitch and talking about who else is on the show and, you know, how the other characters work and where does this actually occur? Is it in a city? Is it in the, you know, is it out in the suburbs somewhere or whatever? And you make all those decisions, and then basically what happened was that we pitched it in New York because this was a New York-grown project. And these guys loved the show. They loved the idea. And they loved Michael Jacobs. And I still can remember, this is a very long time ago, that they sent me a play that he wrote called Cheaters. I actually remember the title of the play. And I read the thing, and I just thought it was terrific, and I thought he was a real good. Not only was it terrific, but he was a good match for sitcom writing. And then the long story short was in the pitch, let's say it was the Charles in Charge pitch, you know, you would go into a room and you would try to get comfortable, as I tried to get comfortable in the beginning of this conversation. You guys got to save me in terms of just, you know, people, you know, it's, you know, hopefully there's a little cute repartee, and you tell a couple of jokes, and you catch up with people, etc. So you try to get a little comfortable. I always liked, in pitching, talking about how the genesis of the idea came along, because it was an honest thing to say to somebody, to actually tell them, look, I was sitting in my office one day, and Roseanne Lido from Scholastic picked up the telephone and told me this idea, and she didn't have to say more than two or three sentences before I thought, that's a great idea. And then she followed up by sending it the material, the play material from Michael Jacobs, and I thought it was terrific. And, you know, it was kind of like a marriage made in heaven. And then basically on the television pitch, you know, what you do is you orient them. You talk about what the series basically is. You introduce who the characters basically are in kind of a thumbnail. You might give them a sense of the kind of pilot that you'd like to do. You know, in television, there's, you know, it's either a pilot that is a premise pilot, which is the basic first show that you'd see on the air that introduces everything, or it would be a representative pilot. So you kind of schmooze around that. And then you also give them a, you know, samples, quick, you know, TV guide capsule samples of the kind of episodes that you'd like to, you know, that you could foresee in this series. And it's as simple as that. And as I said, I would be, because I don't like public speaking, and it's funny that I had a zillion pitches at various places over a long career, but I would try to get myself comfortable, and I would try to use the energy. Like, I'm not working off talking points right now because it's better to kind of be spontaneous, and because I'm honestly talking about, you know, things that I believe. So it's not like I have to, you know, contrive some kind of a technique. As a matter of fact, it doesn't work. What works is, you know, trying to be basically make contact with people, be honest, listen to if they have something to say or a question to ask, and actually try to enjoy the pitch. And as I always tell people, you know, there's a reason they're there. They're there because they're looking for something. And maybe you're the guy who's walking in the room who's going to give them something that they actually really need for themselves. So it's kind of an equal situation, although at times it doesn't feel like an equal situation because, you know, you're the guy going in and knocking on the door, and they ostensibly are, you know, the big shot that you have to please. Well, it's not always that way.
Well, you know, as writers, and I think you brought up a good point, as writers we're taught to create great characters, and that's certainly true. But in pitching, it almost sounds like the concept of the story is perhaps the most important part of the pitch, at least early on. Is that how you would see it?
Well, I do see it that way, and I also see it that you have to give people an overview. I don't like it when, and I'm sure that you get this, I get this with clients of mine, where they may start talking around something, but you don't have a sense of what it is. So tell me what it is. Give me an overview. The same way that in a movie you would have an establishing shot before you do, you know, two shots or close-ups or whatever. You would have a sense of the, you know, of what the gestalt of it is. And then
right.
From there, you can start working towards the rest of it. You know, in a feature pitch, it's, you know, you want to present something that has a beginning, middle, and an end, that has some surprises, that, you know, where you can point out a few scenes that will knock their socks off, and maybe even keep them curious about the ending. But it's basically about telling a story. You know, there used
right.
to be, there was this book that Don Hewitt wrote, the guy who founded 60 Minutes, and I think it was called Tell Me a Story. And the book was all about his theory. I mean, this is a guy doing a news show and doing segments on a news show, but he always looked at those stories as stories, things that were interesting and fascinating, and that if you told someone, you know, and you presented it in the right way, they would be as fascinated as he was when he decided to put the story on the air. That's a very important distinction.
Yeah, excellent point. Hey, do you mind if we took a caller and have them kind of give you a pitch, and then we can try to help them out and give them some suggestions?
Sure.
All right, I'm going to take a call. Caller, area code 727. We're going to put you on live here in a second. Here you go. Caller's from 727 area code. Who are we speaking with? You're live on Screen Talk Radio.
Hi, Randy Korn. How you doing?
Good, Randy.
Randy.
How are you doing?
I'm in Clearwater,
Randy,
Florida.
Go ahead, Randy. What was that?
I'm in Clearwater, Florida.
Hey, nice to join you. Nice to join the show. Welcome. You're here with Craig Kellum. Do you have a pitch you want to kind of throw his way and get some feedback on?
Yeah, I do. Uh-huh.
Well, go ahead and fire away, and we'll give you about 30 seconds, and then we can stop him, Craig, and if you want to ask some questions or just kind of start giving him feedback when he's done, go ahead.
All right, cool. It's called The Heart of the Beast. The Heart of the Beast is a dramatic horror story that asks a simple question. Can a man have a change of heart? Josh Randall is a relentless pursuer of wealth and power. He's armed with an MBA, and he finds himself in the corporate world in charge of many subordinates. He wields his power ruthlessly with the goal of intimidating all those around him. His goal is the bottom line, himself at the expense of others. He enjoys watching others cower in fear before him. He lives for the time he can personally lay off others in order to enhance his Christmas bonus. Through a twist of fate on Christmas Eve, he finds himself in a dark, winding road that is blocked by a station wagon. He stops to investigate and is mauled to death by a rare Tibetan wolf. Lying in a hospital with the moon shining through the window, he transforms into a werewolf and jumps out the window to the streets below. He prowls the streets and howls at the moon, stalking all those who cross his path. His victims are those who appear to glow red, murderers, rapists, and bad criminals alike. The ones he befriends are the victims of the criminals, which he sees with a blue, soothing glow. To the police, he is a crazy maniac, but to those he saves, he is a vigilante werewolf and their savior. Through the experience, Josh has a change of heart towards those around him, treating them with a newfound respect, and the ones who once feared and hated him saw the change and learned to respect and like him. By night, he prowls and strikes fear in the hearts of criminals and a hope in the hearts of others. He is hunted like an animal by a lonely police detective who doesn't believe.
Okay, Randy, what was your... Randy, go ahead and stop there. What was your opening pitch? Read that first line again.
Okay. The Heart of the Beast is a dramatic horror story that asks a simple question. Can a man have a change of heart?
Now, Craig, I liked his opening, but it seemed to kind of... I kind of lost it after a while. What would be some of your main critiques, Craig, for Randy here with his pitch that you heard?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very tough thing to get on the phone like this and pitch something. So I'm very sympathetic either to the that situation. And I know that I just went through a whole spiel about it's better not to read something.
Right.
So what I would suggest, just in talking about the technique of the pitch, is to really, have an idea of what you're talking about, which you obviously do. It's a script that you wrote. And trust the fact that you might be able to describe it better and be more effective the way that you would be, you describe it to a guy that you were flying with and, having drinks with on a plane or something. Right. And you were telling a story and really enjoying the process of, of telling the story to someone and then, kind of enjoying the contact involved. It's hard for a listener to listen to somebody actually read something. You shift into a different level of attention. And there's a better level of attention, which is human contact, really, making almost anecdotal. Now, as far as the project itself is concerned, I'm not sure. I think that the idea of a heroic werewolf is a good idea if it hasn't been done before, or it hasn't been done before recently.
Right.
And I think that I like the idea that, this werewolf is a werewolf, so obviously people are trying to hunt it down, and it's kind of ironic because it's out there doing exactly what it shouldn't be doing. And I do think that it would be interesting if, getting into this persona, this werewolf, this neo-werewolf, was completely confused about exactly what he was doing, who he was, what he was supposed to do, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Uh-huh. And that part of the, kind of meat of the story is him finding his legs, so to speak, as a werewolf and falling into this role, which is completely, the opposite of what you would expect him to, the way that you expect him to be, and maybe also completely the opposite, as you described his nature, of his nature. So all of a sudden, as a real person, he's not the nicest guy in the world, and as a werewolf, he's a mensch. So to me, there would be, a lot of interesting sides to that, And I don't know whether it's in the script or not, but that's my reaction to the idea.
Yeah, it's interesting.
All right, well, hey, Randy, thank you for calling. We appreciate it, and hopefully that was some help. And
yeah.
Take care, and good luck with your project.
Good luck, Randy.
Craig, that's all the time we have. I appreciate we had some more callers that unfortunately we're not going to get to them, but we're going to be doing more shows in the future with the opportunity for writers to call in and get feedback on pitches. And Craig, we appreciate your time. And why don't you give us a plug? You have a website where writers can contact you and get some help with their screenplays. What's your website?
I have my business is called HollywoodScript.com, and I do, you know, I consult on screenplays, and I also work with works in progress.
All right. So, writers, if you want to correspond with Craig and get some help via his business, please check him out. And, Craig, once again, thank you for the time. And
thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, you're listening to Screen Talk Radio. We're going to take about a 30-second break, and then we've got Jim Vines up. He's a professional screenwriter and author of the book The Working Screenwriter. We'll be joined live by Mr. Vines in a moment. Welcome back to Screen Talk Radio. We're going to be joined in a second by Jim Vines. Devin, what do you think of Mr. Kellum there? It was kind of interesting to have the old development executive on the other end of the microphone, I guess you could say, in terms of being a little nervous being on live radio. That was kind of cool.
Yeah. I think he took my advice, though. He just pictured everybody naked.
Well, that'd be kind of scary thought. If you've seen pictures of you and I, that would be kind of scary.
But fortunately, this is radio, so we don't have to worry about that.
All right. Our next guest, we've got about 8 minutes to go. We're going to talk briefly with Mr. Jim Vines. He's a professional screenwriter of one of the films, House at the End of the Drive. And he's also the author of the book, The Working Screenwriter. And he also has a website, theworkingscreenwriter.com. We're joined live by Jim Vines. Jim, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Good, Jim. I'm glad that you could join us and take time out of your schedule. I'm sorry we got you a little late, but once again, we appreciate you joining us here live.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Could you give us a little bit about your website and what it is you offer writers and of course, your book?
Well, the website I put together a couple of years ago after I had been doing critiques for several years, and I kept getting the same script over and over. I had done dozens and dozens of these critiques, and everyone kept making the same mistakes. There was, you know, maybe 20 mistakes that, you know, common mistakes that people kept making. So people would write to me and say, you know, what should I do when I write my script? What should I watch out for? So instead of just continually writing up the same responses, I put together the website, and now I just tell people, go to my website. And, you know, I have a section called The Fatal Flaws, and I list, you know, just all these different things that people need to really be aware of when they're writing their first scripts.
What are some of the main fatal flaws that you see beginning screenwriters or anybody make that you've written about?
Well, I mean, there's the simple stuff. There's the, you know, the punctuation and the formatting and, you know, proper ways to do all that. But I mean, you know, ask yourself, is this a story that lends itself to a cinematic experience? Is this something I want to go spend, you know, $10-$12 to see in a movie theater? Is this something I want to rent at the video store? Most scripts that I've received to do critiques on, you know, were basically, you know, maybe a story about a guy looking for his car keys. I mean, you know, how do you pad that out to 2 hours? I mean, you really can't. So that's one of the first things you have to ask yourself. You know, dialogue. I mean, if you have a bank robber or let's say a car thief carjacking a Mercedes from a lawyer, they're not both probably both not going to be speaking the same way. I had a script I did once where the car thief or the carjacker said, "Come on, man, get out of the car," you know, and then the lawyer who is driving the Mercedes says, "Hey, man, what you crazy?" You know, I mean, it's the same dialogue. There's no distinction. So that's another thing, is that usually the person writing the script puts his or her voice into each and every character throughout the script, where each character has to be distinctive. You should be able to cover up the slug, the name slug, and read the dialogue and, for the most part, figure out, okay, that's that character or that's that character. You know, each character has a different sound. So that's just another thing people need to watch out for. I mean, there's many different things. I wish I could come up with more.
Of all the screenplays that you read, in all honesty, what percentage of them are savable or salvageable?
All right, the common held number, I think, every time I talk to a producer or an agent, the number that always comes up is 99% are unmarketable. And that is a number that I've been using for quite some time. I always tell people 99% of all the scripts floating around being written, you know, by budding screenwriters, 99% are completely unmarketable.
So we've got 99 out of 100 writers who literally have no shot, and they don't know it, but yet they're still working on it.
Well, they no shot with the script they're presently working on. I mean, I'm sure they're... I mean, when I started writing, I was a pretty decent writer, but I was nowhere near professional level. I had the basics down. I just needed to write several scripts, and that's the problem, is most people, they think they write their first script, and they're ready to rock and roll and send it out after two drafts, and then they're going to make a sale. Well, it's not the way it works. I mean, it can, and it has once or twice in the history of, you know, screenwriting, but really, you need to write, you know, at least several scripts, you know, three or four or five. I think I wrote maybe six or seven before I was really ready to sell anything. I mean, you know, Diablo Cody comes along and...
Go ahead. That seems part of the problem is too many writers, they don't wait for five or six screenplays. They think after one or two, you know, they're looking for help on how to pitch their story.
Exactly, and I think the culture of today is everyone wants immediate gratification. They just... Oh, I'm going to go get the script program. I'm going to go get the laptop and put the script program on there. I'm going to go to Starbucks, and I've seen movies before, so I know how that goes. And, gee, I wrote a paper once in high school, so I can write. So they sit down and they try and crank out a screenplay, and it's just not the way it works. It's just not the way it works. You have to put the time in, and that time can be months. It could be years. It could be never. I mean, there's some people out there trying to write screenplays that will never write a marketable screenplay. I've had people come to me with their scripts, and I'll critique their script, and they're just absolutely awful. There's nothing there really worth saving. And they say, "Well, let me go and do a couple of rewrites." So they come back to me 6 months later, and they say, "What do you think now?" And I read it, and it's no better. In fact, it's probably worse. That's happened to me several times. There's some people that just don't get it, then they won't get it. And I feel bad because I know they're trying, but it's, you know, I want to be able to play the piano, but I'm never going to go up on stage and play for people because I just can't do it. You know, not everyone is meant to write screenplays. But if you have the basic talent, you need to work at it, and you need to work at it every single day. You know, read a few of the screenwriting books. You know, read a ton of movie screenplays, professional screenplays. They're out there on the net. They're free. They're available for download. And study and put the time in. Write two scripts, three scripts, four, as many as it takes. If you're getting good feedback from people after, you know, a couple of scripts, then keep going. But if people keep telling you your stuff sucks, I don't know what to tell you.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, that's our time. If anyone wants to get some feedback from you or check out what you can offer, it's your website, theworkingscreenwriter.com, correct?
Theworkingscreenwriter.com, and I have a blog, very popular blog, theworkingscreenwriter.blogspot.com, and they can reach me through those if they wish.
All right, Jim, thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it.
All right, Chris, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, that's the show today, Screen Talk Radio. We appreciate you taking the time. Once again, we will not be here next week, but we'll join you the week after on March 18th. Check back here for Screen Talk Live. Thank you.
shout out to every young brother, you know, just doing his bit right now. Keep your head up. Just walking that yard, wish he had wings and just, you know, fly out of that joint.